Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Why not sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources? That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White, and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we are going to be talking about an issue which we should flag up as a bit of a health warning, is a sensitive topic for lots of different reasons. We're going to be talking about circumcision, and at points we will have to talk about some of the slightly more gory details involved in both circumcision and, as we'll get to later, what used to be called female circumcision and is now known as female genital mutilation. So, just be aware that we are going to have to talk about some of the more... some of the medical aspects, some of the ethical aspects of that, for what is quite a sensitive issue. And this all came about because we had an interesting question from a listener called Casey, and Casey wrote this. Have you talked about circumcision on the podcast at all? It seems that as an American, we're led to believe that the pros far outweigh the cons of this practice, that it's an acceptable medical practice. However, this doesn't seem to be the case for how the rest of the world might view this, even in Europe. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts about this as a European Christian. I am an American Christian and mother of two boys and one girl. So this is something that I think all of our American listeners will immediately understand, but some of our other listeners may not. While circumcision in our kind of UK context is largely understood as a primarily Jewish and Muslim kind of minority religious practice, that's not the case, is it, in America? It's much more mainstream.
Yes, it seems that in America, it's often been seen as a sort of routine medical procedure, which is recommended for all newborn male babies, and it's interesting, and that this is seen as a medical thing. It's not associated with religious or ethnic practices, but for quite a long time, I think, was quite strongly recommended by paediatricians, family doctors, and others in the US. It's interesting to compare that, but because that never was the case in the UK.
No. I remember when I found out this, being kind of totally baffled, because when I grew up, you know, I had solely heard of circumcision as a thing that only you would only do if you were a Jew, and later understood that some Muslims also circumcise their boys. And so it was kind of startling to realize that actually most American males, I think the best estimates are something in the region of 70-80% of men right now are circumcised. Though the numbers have been falling, if you look at newborns born, you know, this year, the surveys in recent years have suggested it's something more closer to 50%. But still, you know, very large numbers, almost all of whom will not be Jewish or Muslim, choosing, as you say, to get circumcised for health reasons. What are those health reasons then, if it's not been done for kind of ritualistic or religious practices?
Yeah, and there is quite a lot of evidence that although it has become contested, quite a lot of evidence that it reduces complications. So fundamentally, infections of different types, so urinary tract infections, infections of the foreskin itself and the tip of the penis, but also sexually transmitted infections, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, there's quite good evidence that male circumcision is associated with a reduction in sexually transmitted infections, including HIV. And I think it's pretty clear that that it was for those kind of reasons that American pediatricians recommended circumcision. Of course, the Jewish lobby is very strong in the States, particularly in academic and in medical circles. And so I suspect that because Jewish circumcision was very commonly practiced and accepted, there was a strong tendency for, therefore, other academics to assume that maybe there was some kind of medical benefit. I remember preachers sometimes, when they come to circumcision, from a Christian point of view, talking about the health benefits as a kind of justification for this sign in the Old Testament.
You hear similar things when as you say, preachers come to those bits in Leviticus and the Pentateuch about dietary laws or things like that, saying that, you know, while these are primarily about ensuring clear divides between the people of Israel and the surrounding nations, they actually also may have had some kind of ancillary side benefits around hygiene. According to the New York Times, the evidence is that if you're uncircumcised and you're a boy aged under two, you have a risk of a urinary tract infection of about 1%. And if you are circumcised, that decreases to about 0.1%. So low risk in both instances, but there may be some help there. Some other studies have suggested that adult men who were circumcised as babies were less likely to get penile cancer. But apparently this is a bit of a less of a protective effect, and is also kind of contested whether that is related to other issues around hygiene and regular cleaning of the penis and things like that.
And just as a sort of aside, it's just interesting to reflect the differences in attitudes between American physicians and British physicians, particularly paediatricians, because the tradition in which I was brought up and trained as a British paediatrician, it has a very strong commonsensical element with such things as if it ain't broke, don't fix it, and, you know, do what seems common sense unless there's a very strong reason not to. Whereas I think the American tradition for decades has been more interventionist, more prone to recommend surgical procedures, even if the evidence is not compelling. And of course, you know, one has to say that there are strong commercial elements here, you know, that American paediatricians and surgeons and clinicians have a financial incentive to recommend procedures which will increase their income. And because British paediatricians have since the foundation of the NHS have really never had that incentive, we have a more neutral ability to analyze the evidence.
There's a really and on that, over-treatment is a well-known phenomenon in American medical circles for that very reason, because of the insurance system. The American Academy of, or is it Association? The American Academy of Pediatrics issued a policy statement on circumcision in 2012 after spending several years gathering some experts and reviewing the evidence. And they said that the preventative health benefits of elective circumcision of male newborns outweigh the risks, primarily urinary tract infections, and subsequently the risks of acquisition of HIV and other sexually transmitted infections. However, the health benefits are not great enough to recommend routine circumcision for all male newborns, but they are sufficient to justify access to this procedure for families choosing it and to warrant third-party payment for circumcision of male newborns. So this is a subset of the debate in America, is whether, of course, circumcision should be seen as a kind of elective procedure that parents pay for themselves, or whether it should be covered on your insurance plan, whether that is a private one or through Medicaid, which is the kind of state-provided insurance that you get if you're poor enough.
Yeah, and actually this reminds me of a discussion we had you know, over a year ago about transgender, the treatment of transgender children and adolescents, and comparing the American Pediatric Association, which was strongly in favour of giving hormonal treatment to children with gender dysphoria, compared with the new British approach of being much more cautious. Yes. And again, it was suggested that one of the factors was this commercial incentive for American pediatricians.
Hmm. So if the evidence is that it might have some minor benefits, but they're not hugely significant, do we expect it will gradually kind of continue to dwindle away, except for those religious minorities who are kind of committed to it for other reasons?
It's very difficult to predict the future, isn't it? But that would be my presumption. It is interesting how culturally, whereas previously America was a very medicalized culture compared with Britain. I remember, you know, with traveling in America, being struck by, for instance, the adverts directed at patients, which often had huge amounts of detailed medical information, and yet which was seen to be entirely appropriate to be directed at the average consumer, compared to the British approach, which has seen... it is much less medicalized. So I think that historically America, you know, in the 20th century was a very medicalized culture, and which took the views of medical experts extremely seriously. It's fascinating that just in the last decade, with the rise of populism, and particularly following the during and following the pandemic, there seems to have been a complete revolution in American attitudes. So that now, you know, populist attitudes which sort of deride medical experts and their recommendations, it has become, you know, very common in the States.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe that, yeah, the end of deference, once it's gone, it's not never coming back. The era of deference to the doctor knows best. In the UK context, it's not routine, but did you ever get requested by parents of a newborn child that they would like their son to be circumcised?
It was occasionally raised by parents as to what I thought about the health benefits. But it was that, to be honest, that was pretty unusual. I think most parents, it just wasn't an issue. If it was raised, I would, you know, just review it with them. But I think I would come down, if you ask my advice, I would say it wasn't medically necessary, and that... I mean, we had three boys, and as you know, none of them, we arranged for them to be circumcised.
Thanks for that. Great.
So, but I think we should sort of move on then to the fact that both Orthodox Jewish people and people from an Islamic religious background see circumcision of males as something very important. Mm. And indeed, particularly within the Orthodox Jewish community, this is seen as completely mandatory for all observant Jews. And there is a quite complex and well-established procedure with specially trained rabbis called moels who undertake this procedure at 8 days of age, visiting the baby and the family in their own home, performing the procedure as a ritual act of worship. My experience as a pediatrician is actually they're clearly highly skilled, and I don't remember ever seeing a case of a medical complication caused by the activities of a mole at 8 days of age.
Which seems remarkable, given, as you say, these are not doctors. This is not taking place in a kind of sterile hospital setting. Do they know to properly sterilize their instruments and about wound care? I mean, I guess the Jews have been doing this a long time. They probably figured out how to do it without killing the babies.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. I think there's a huge historic experience. And of course, the Jews, above all everyone else, have an ability to pass on historical, you know, and exactly how to do it and what the risks are. And interestingly, there are exceptions. So in a case where there's possibly some medical condition, I was asked sometimes by the parents whether I felt it would be safe for the baby to undergo ritual circumcision. And if my conclusion was, well, perhaps no, it wouldn't, they would take that very seriously. And in fact, the mole wouldn't carry it out unless, in any medically questionable case, unless the doctors had approved it.
Mm. So they kind of, in a sense, got kind of almost integrated into medical pediatric practice. Well, not integrated, but, you know, you knew who these rabbis were. They knew who you were. There was a kind of degree of understanding between the two teams.
Yes, and that reflects the fact that there is a very significant representation of Jewish people in British medicine, including highly observant Orthodox Jews. And therefore, there's a great deal of understanding and awareness of medical perspectives and of specifically religious Jewish perspectives, and also a great desire not to create a misunderstanding or any kind of anti-Semitism.
Because obviously, sadly, there is a long history, particularly in Europe, of Jewish religious practices being kind of demonized. You have the kind of famous case of like the blood libel, this kind of anti-Semitic conspiracy theory myth that Jews are stealing Christian children and drinking their blood and things like this. And so you can appreciate that particularly for Orthodox Jews, they are very sensitive to the idea that this practice, which, as you say, is intrinsic to their identity as Jews, it's what defines a man as a Jew, in the line going all the way back to Abraham, who was first told to do this in Genesis by God himself. The idea that this becomes misunderstood or misconstrued as child abuse is a terrifying prospect.
Yes, it is. And I think it's interesting to compare that with the Islamic culture and the fact that until relatively recently, Islam didn't have a close connection with Western medicine, and Islamic practices, you know, which were based in the Middle East and in North Africa and so on, developed without a very strong relationship with Western medicine. And my understanding is that there isn't the same equivalent within Islam of the moles of specially trained circumcisers. And it was an issue, therefore, that sadly I did see on a number of occasions where attempts had been made at ritual circumcision in the Islamic community, that there were sometimes really very significant medical complications because it had gone wrong in some way. Mm. That there were people who were undertaking this who were not medically qualified, or sometimes it was a GP, you know, who has been persuaded to undertake circumcision without sort of proper training and qualification. Mm. And as a result, complications had developed. And particularly, it's interesting that whereas ritual circumcision at 8 days of age, as practiced by the Jews, seems to be very, very safe and uncomplicated when practiced in their particular way, when circumcision is carried out in older children, you know, who are months or years old, there's much more potential for things to go horribly wrong. And to be honest, the only safe way for a circumcision to be carried out beyond 8 days of age is as a full surgical procedure, which means general anaesthetic, trained paediatric surgeon, and proper hospital support with all the necessary ways to deal with such problems as hemorrhage and other things, infection and so on.
Hmm.
Have you ever found yourself wondering if it's still possible to have civil conversations in today's culture wars? That's exactly why we want to send you a brand new and exclusive booklet called Arguing for the Sake of Heaven, a look at the life and legacy of Charlie Kirk. This compelling resource reflects on Charlie's legacy and the controversies he sparked, but more importantly, it explores how we can recover the art of disagreeing agreeably. In a polarized world, how do we defend free speech, speak the truth in love, and pursue truth without fear? I believe this is a resource that every thoughtful Christian should have. And right now, it's our special thanks to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support helps ensure that content like this podcast and so many others continue reaching people who are searching for wisdom, truth, and hope. So I encourage you to give today by visiting premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death to receive your copy today. Now, let's get back to today's episode.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And this leads to, I think, the second part of our conversation, which is really about what used to be known as female circumcision, and is also quite prevalent, particularly, but not exclusively, in the Islamic world, so North Africa and the Middle East, but is now commonly referred to as female genital mutilation, or FGM. Which I think in times gone by was seen in those communities and by Westerners observers as broadly equivalent. But then following, actually, interestingly, according to Wikipedia, by some campaigns primarily by female Christian missionaries to those parts of Africa, it was kind of reinterpreted as not equivalent. Female FGM was not equivalent to male circumcision, and is now, in the last kind of 10 or 15 years, has been a renewed campaign in many European countries to try and further criminalize and stamp this procedure out entirely.
Yes. So FGM, you know, although superficially you think, well, you know, it's the same as male circumcision. In fact, it's really important to understand that it is totally different and unfortunately is barbaric. So it isn't an Islamic.
No,
it isn't really part of Islam. It is part of the folk culture of certain North African, in particular, a tribal culture, and it's pretty clear that it's not done for religious reasons. It's done because women are regarded as the property rights of men. And there is a great concern about women being involved in sexual activity without male supervision. And therefore, this mutilating procedure is designed to remove the organs of sexual arousal, the clitoris and the labia, the lips around the female genitals, and is also often to sew up the vaginal opening to prevent the possibility of intercourse with a male. It's a massive, compared to removal of the foreskin, it's a massive procedure, and it's often carried out barbarically in young women, female children at different ages, but it may be all the way up to, you know, adolescence. Is often carried out, you know, in very unsterile and no anesthetic, and is a fairly horrific practice, and is largely carried out by older women.
Yes, a particularly tragic aspect of it for me is as you say, it is mostly carried out by kind of mothers and aunties and grandmothers who were themselves the victims of FGM as children, on the next generation down. And from what I understand is, as you say, is often thought by many communities to be part of Islamic ritual practice, but is actually a older cultural practice, which is not required in the Quran or in traditional Islamic teaching. And in fact, is known in non-Islamic communities and tribes in these same parts of North Africa and the Middle East. and is believed by historians to predate the arrival of Islam, and is mostly about exercising social control over female sexuality, and is often therefore associated with a kind of transition into puberty, or sometimes there are kind of partial reversals of it that take place on your wedding day when you're now allowed to have sex and things like that.
Sadly has lifelong consequences, that it tends to mean that women can never have any kind of sexual pleasure. It may mean there's intense pain in any kind of sexual relations. There's often scarring and infection and so on. I mean, it really is a horrific practice. And I fully support, therefore, the attempt. You know, this is child physical abuse. And it really has no justification on religious or cultural grounds. And therefore, I fully support the attempt by Western states and by social services and by paediatricians to try to eliminate this practice.
Yes. So in the last kind of 10 or 15 years, there's been a renewed attention to this. I mean, particularly in the UK, I'm most familiar with, where, you know, there are significant diaspora communities of Muslims and others from the parts of North Africa and the Middle East where FGM is commonplace. And there are kind of there were growing concerns that this was still happening kind of in backdoor procedures. And so there was kind of strengthened laws about 10 years ago to both criminalize parents for taking their children to be mutilated, and also for those who carry out the mutilation, and a kind of renewed kind of public awareness campaign. With, I think, some success, though it's still not the case that it's been completely eliminated. But what I think this has spilled over is the renewed conversation and the kind of renewed rebranding of what was once female circumcision, but we now understand as FGM, has led people, understandably, just to re-examine the much more commonplace and tolerated practice of male circumcision. And in fact, some people argue it should be now known as male genital mutilation or MGM.
Indeed, and you can see how that idea could be promoted. Of course, it then leads one into the rather embarrassing situation that a large number of medical authorities, particularly the states, are recommending male genital mutilation at birth, you know, which is slightly problematic. And I think that there are a number of differences, which I think should be obvious from our discussion now, that male circumcision has this very strong historical precedent as a uniquely religious act amongst Jewish people, and that the comparison between the possible complications of male circumcision, particularly as carried out by the Jewish moles, compared with female genital mutilation, there is just no comparison. And therefore, although there is clearly an issue here, a delicate issue, and it'd be interesting just to move to that, really, wouldn't it? To say, in a modern society which tries to encompass people from many different ethnic communities and religious beliefs, including people, weirdos who believe in Christianity and that Jesus actually was God incarnate, how do we work out as a society what are the boundaries and the limits of what we would allow and require of parents?
Yes, but I think here goes the argument from the people who would like to rebrand it as MGM, including there is a small number of people who were themselves circumcised as children, both in the United States and also people who have, you know, circumcised as Jews or Muslims and have subsequently either left the faith or kind of reinterpreted and don't believe it's necessary, who argue that they were mutilated by their parents, that they have experienced lifelong medical complications. And they say, look, if a brand new religion was started tomorrow, And the practitioners said, as a vital part of our religion, we had to snip off the earlobes of our newborn children. The medical establishment and the law would be immediate and unanimous in saying, it doesn't matter that you can live without earlobes. It doesn't matter that that wound heals quickly. It doesn't matter that the child is left with no psychological trauma. You're not allowed to cut skin off your child's body for a purely ritual purpose. We will criminalize this immediately. I think that's unarguable. And so the argument goes, it is only because the Jews and other religious groups like Muslims have been doing this for so long, and because it is so commonplace and well-established in those diaspora communities here in the West, that we don't have the same approach to male circumcision.
Yeah, well, you know, the problem with these counterfactual is that you can always dream up possible religions and... You know, it's the kind of things that philosophers love doing, but in the real world, it often doesn't help a great deal. I'm not so sure. I think if in America, out in the, you know, the wilds of Utah,
careful,
we were to discover a group of religious believers who passionately believed that there was something very significant about the earlobes, and that they were prepared to sacrifice their lives or take up arms in order to defend the earlobe. Are we as paediatricians going to say, absolutely no way, you know, there is no way that you should ever be allowed to do something to the earlobes? We allow parents to put in... earrings and into earlobes. I mean, despite some discomfort for me as a paediatrician with his risks of infection and so on. So I think actually, you know, in the real world, there is a kind of commonsensical thing about harm. And a very helpful concept, which I came across some years ago and which I've since tried to promote, is the idea that of what are called zones of the zone of parental discretion. But perhaps just to back up on that, the first thing to say is that what we all know, and particularly what we know as paediatricians, is that perfect parenting doesn't exist, that all parenting is substandard. You could always find ways of saying that that really wasn't a very, you know, wise or good activity, Mrs. Parent. And therefore, this concept has grown of good enough parenting. You know, what we're looking for is not perfect parenting, but what we do expect is that every parent of a child, at least in the UK, should be providing good enough parenting that meets a certain minimum standard. So, and that means that effectively we've ended up with three zones of activities. We've ended up with zones of activities which parents must not do. You must not abuse your child. In fact, in the UK, you must not smack your child. You must not inflict any degree of physical punishment on your children. That is in the zone of what you must not do. You must not give poisons to your children. You must not, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You must not expose them to female genital mutilation. These are things you must not do. You must not give alcohol to your children in more than trivial amounts, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the zone of that parents must not do. And then there's a zone of parents must do. You must protect your child from harm. You must feed them. You must keep them clean. You must bring them, provide education when they're old enough in some form or other. And this is the zone where parents must do. And then there is quite a big zone of in between those two of parental discretion. You can decide whether to immunize your children or not. You can decide whether to have your child circumcised or not. You can decide a great deal about what you feed them with, what kind of weird diet and you expose them to. And we have decided this is within the zone of parental discretion. And so we have decided that male circumcision of young babies performed under proper restrictions are within the zone of parental discretion, whereas female genital mutilation is outside it.
And I guess the argument goes then that there doesn't seem to be very clear rationale for what we put in the zone of discretion and what we put in the zone of prohibition. I mean, you mentioned smacking, you know, hitting your children as physical kind of corporal punishment, chastisement, which was, you know, historically incredibly commonplace. It was in schools. It was in every home up and down the land. And yet over, you know, your lifetime, effectively, Dad, that has gradually been, there's been a cultural sea change where if you'd said 60 years ago, parents should not have the discretion to smack their child on the bottom when they do something naughty, you would have been laughed at. And yet now,
well, explaining that to my father, you know, your grandfather would have been appalled. You know, this is ridiculous. I mean, ridiculous. This is, of course, it says,
It's in the Bible, you know, spare the rod. Bible. Yeah. And yet now several jurisdictions in the West, including parts of the UK, have literally criminalized it, even when it is done, you know, not out of anger, not doesn't leave a mark. You know, it is criminalized. You may not lay a hand on your child to punish them. So things can move between the zones as culture shifts, even though smacking is no more harmful today than it was 60 years ago and no less harmful. And so I think it is reasonable to say, putting to one side the fact that it would make a lot of religious minorities very unhappy, that it is reasonable to question, should this ritual removal of a piece of child's body, when they cannot consent to this at 8 days old, be within the zone of discretion, even if we don't think it's that harmful? It's certainly, is it really less harmful than the light tap on the bottom of a five-year-old who's done something naughty?
Well, I think an American pediatrician anyway would say, well, absolutely, because here's all these health benefits. You know, here's this reduction in UTIs, here's urinary tract infections, here's reductions in cancer, here's sexually transmitted infections, penile, and so on. So you always weigh benefits and risks, but you can't overstate the risks of circumcision done properly compared to its benefits. So I think there is an argument even there. But I think there's a wider argument, and that is, it has been said, and I think there's truth in about it, in many ways, the kind of society which we're now trying to live in Western countries is an experiment. It's never before been successfully carried out in the history of the world. Previously, every society had one single, absolutely dominant culture, and within limits, all visitors to that society were expected to comply with the dominant culture. For the first time in the history of the world, we are trying to create pluralistic, sometimes called multicultural, you know, there are different words you can use, societies which tolerate and respect a whole range of different cultures. There isn't one dominant culture. And that in order for this experiment to succeed, it needs a great deal of humility, sensitivity, preparedness to, quotes, bend the rules or to, you know, adapt principles, all in the interest of this wider thing, which is social harmony in a deeply contested and diverse community. And we as Christians, who represent a small minority in our culture, certainly as observant Christians who want to have the full orthodox religious beliefs, it is in our interests to argue for this kind of humility, openness, toleration, and so on within our society.
Yes, I can see the strength of that argument, and particularly it's not hard to think of areas in which Christian parents might value a precedent being set, which is that the state cannot dictate within, you know, as long as I'm not, you know, causing serious, obvious physical harm to my child, the state cannot interfere in my parental choices, my discretion. And, you know, for Christians, it might not be around circumcision. It probably shouldn't be around circumcision. The New Testament comes to a quite clear conclusion on that Christians don't need to be circumcised like Jews. But there are lots of things, and then probably a growing number of things, in which Christian parents might be at variance with kind of wider popular culture about how they raise their children. So clearly I can see the value in saying there is religious minorities, no matter how bizarre or even reviled their practices might be, should be permitted to carry them out. I guess the flip side of that, well, sorry, you wanted to say?
Well, and I just want to say that, and of course, where the rubber hits the road at the moment for this is very much in terms of sexual ethics, that if the dominant culture was to say that all Christians must teach their children of the of the dominant sexual ethic, that and that sexual orientation is a matter of choice and variability, and that the state insists that every child is taught by their parents, and that this is supported by their parents, the current sexual practices and so on, this would create great tensions for Christian parents. Or suppose that the state said, for whatever reason, we ban communion. You know, Holy Communion is from now on is a proscribed activity, and Christians must not engage in this activity because it's divisive, because it creates problems and so on. So you can see how the need to respect conscience, is a very fundamental part about modern pluralistic societies.
Yes, and the communion example is helpful because there have been societies, totalitarian dictatorships, and other countries where other religions are predominant, where people have tried to restrict Christians' abilities. Often it's around baptism as well. Christians have been barred from being baptized or face sanctions if they do, and also sharing communion. And what have faithful Christians done throughout time and history? They have ignored, they have rejected the state's right to tell them to be faithful to the two ordinances laid down by the Lord Jesus. And they have carried on at great personal cost in secret, breaking bread and drinking wine and baptizing each other. And no doubt that would continue in this country. And no doubt if the state passed a law tomorrow in the UK, said circumcision is now rebranded as MGM and will be criminally sanctioned, are Orthodox Jews going to abandon 3,500 years of tradition? No, they will carry on circumcising their young sons, except that they will do it in a more dangerous way, in more backstreet manners, to try and avoid the prying eyes of the police. And you'll end up, nobody wants the government to kind of effectively end up at war with otherwise peaceful, well-integrated Jewish British Jews.
Yeah, and what's more, if that law was to be passed, and it's not inconceivable, under a radical left-wing government, it's not inconceivable that male circumcision could be outlawed. In that case, I would find myself torn between wanting to respect the law and wanting to protect my co-religionists, and particularly because these are our Jewish older brothers in Hebraic faith, and therefore I would want to protect and to fight very strongly for the rights of Orthodox Jews to carry out their in obedience to their profound beliefs.
Okay, let me just put one more attempt at putting the other case. We talked a bit about this kind of sea change in attitudes to smacking, for example, and kind of corporal punishment by parents, which, I mean, I'll go on the record, I'm all in favour of. I'm opposed to smacking in all circumstances on kind of moral grounds. And we can talk about that another time, perhaps. But I think what it really illustrates is the radical shift in how we approach the kind of parental zone, and that the predominant ethic for hundreds of years in the West, which is that children are effectively the property of their parents, and what parents do, unless they go really overboard, is the state keeps its nose out of their affairs, has been effectively abolished. And mostly driven by our understanding of the catastrophic widespread nature of child sexual abuse, particularly within families, we have now said, actually, no, the government, all of us, have an interest in how someone else's child is being raised and looked after, and we will actively intervene to stop you if we think you're doing something wrong. And I would say that is comes from a deeply Christian root. We talked in previous times about how the early church became famous for collecting the discarded babies. Because why? Because it recognized that even a newborn, even a terminally ill or sick or disabled child was of inestimable value to God and was an equal son or daughter of the Creator and worthy of love, protection, reverence. And I stand on that tradition. I think it's been hugely influential in our culture. And I would see our modern efforts at child protection flowing directly from that root. And so in that sense, is there not a deeply Christian argument to say we have a duty to step in and say, I think these children might be causing being caused harm by this practice, even though it's well-intentioned. And therefore, we do have a duty to not just turn the other way.
Yeah. I mean, of course, there is force in what you're saying, but I would say you're conflating two really very different things. You're conflating the rights of parents over their children with the prospect of permanent, irreducible harm being created. And it's just important to keep those things separate. So in current UK law and practice, there is a recognition that there is a threshold of harm that is required before the state must intervene. Because again, we talked about the fact that we're all good enough parents, you know, it could be demonstrated that our parenting of you, Tim, you know, led to
I've got binders of evidence, Dad. Folders and folders.
Irreducible harm, you know, and there you off you go to the lawyers to say, you know,
yeah, I'm going to this sue is what my parents did to me. Yeah,
absolutely. And similarly, your daughter is no doubt
setting a dangerous precedent
of what
or my manifold failings as a father,
the failings and the harm that you've created.
Yeah.
You know, by failing to recognize X, Y, Z, by inappropriately doing A, B, C, and so on. So the state and the medical authorities and the social services have created a concept of a threshold of harm. And that's a kind of commonsensical threshold, but what it basically means is permanent and significant harm is a threshold at which we must intervene. And so if a child has evidence of harm, that's the threshold we're looking at, something that is permanent and very significant. You know, so in other words, for instance, you know, a parent is not really watching when their child is doing, the child trips over and ends up with a massive bruise on their, you know, and really if the parent had been more, or the parent or the child suddenly slipped the parent's hands or the parent wasn't watching, the child runs in the road and is involved in a road traffic accident. It's necessary for people to take some kind of judgment, you know, what was the level of failure on the parent's heart? Did it pass some kind of threshold? I think that's perfectly appropriate. And there is a deeper principle which we must defend, and that is that parents do have the right to educate, form, discipline their children. That is
and
a
induct
very
them into
deep...
the faith of their choosing.
Exactly. Choose the education for them. Choose their friends. Choose how to dress them. Choose what stories to read to them. Choose where they're going to live. Choose, you know, and that's not something abusive and, you know, inappropriate. That is something which is deeply part of our humanity, that part of being a parent is having that right to
a responsibility that God himself gives each parent.
Exactly right. And so, and what has tended to happen in totalitarian regimes, and you see this very much in the kind of Stalinism and to some extent in China and so on, is that the state does invade that. And the state says, no, you're not allowed to say that. No, you're not allowed to to raise your children and so on. So it's very, we have this balancing act. We must defend the right of parents, even if it leads to some very painful things. It means that parents can, we allow parents to spend ridiculous amounts of sum to educate their children, and give them, you know, if necessarily a personal tutor who, you know, and that gives them massive unfair advantage compared to another child who's had only the benefit of state education. But we allow that to happen. And therefore, this is the balance of respecting parental rights over children, and the state only intervening when we, that threshold of significant and permanent harm is breached.
Mm. And I suppose it all comes down to that fundamental point, the medical point you made in the first half, which is that the evidence suggests that what harms are caused by circumcision are very minor, and in fact may well be outweighed by some potential medical benefits, or at least it's a kind of par. And so we are not, unlike with FGM, we are not talking about children left profoundly lifelong mutilated and damaged by this procedure, even if it might be something that we ourselves have some discomfort with.
That's right. And just to stray, and we must bring this conversation to a close, but just to stray onto the dangerous ground of smacking, the reason why I as a paediatrician support the ban on smacking is not because an occasional reproving tap on the buttocks is in itself likely to cause permanent and lasting and significant harm, but because it's impossible, there is a spectrum between what's appropriate retribution of a naughty child through to completely inappropriate. In other cultures, it's completely routine for parents to really very significantly batter their children, and for there to be permanent bruising and so on, because that's where daddy, you know, I was very naughty, and daddy, quite rightly, he took the
belt to me. Yeah.
So he took the belt to me, and basically the decision has been made that it's not possible to have any kind of gradation of what is reasonable and unreasonable, in a multicultural society where we have people coming from cultures where that kind of behavior is completely normalized. Therefore, the only pragmatic solution which will enable us to agree is to actually have an outright ban. And I think that is an appropriate pragmatic solution in this situation. But that doesn't mean that a single tap on the bottom has gone over that threshold in itself.
Although the complicating factor is, I know, not directly, but through other people, I know of Christians, evangelical Christians, who believe very strongly and would cite Bible verses that is part of their duty as a parent to occasionally physically discipline their children. And they deeply resent the state interfering with what they see as not just a parental choice, but part of their obligation to God to act as strong parents raising their children in the faith. And so you could even turn this into a kind of version of circumcision where it becomes a divide between a secular society and Christian parents.
And that's a very good illustration, therefore, of this principle of toleration and giving way and accepting compromise as all part of this experiment of living as a multicultural and pluralistic society, which does have no single dominant religious or ethnic culture.
Yes, and it'll be interesting to see as the West continues to go in that direction whether, as you say, that experiment can be successful in the long run. As it's not really topic for today, but there's lots of people who, particularly Christians, who argue that it's our kind of jettisoning of a traditional Christian meta-narrative, even by those who aren't personally believers themselves, has causing problems. And that kind of ties into that Christian nationalism conversation we had in an earlier podcast. We'll have to return to another date, but that's probably enough on circumcision for now. Thanks very much.
Thank goodness.
Yes. Everyone can stop wincing and uncross their legs, all our male listeners. Thank you very much to Casey, our listener, who sent in that brilliant question that inspired this conversation. It's a really great question. So thanks to her and for everyone else who continues to send in their thoughts. We'd love to know your own thoughts, your disagreements. What do we miss? What do we say? What have we got wrong? What have we not talked about? You can get in touch with us by emailing MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. You can find lots of interesting resources on Dad's website, lots of talks, links to books, articles, podcasts, etc. That's John Wyatt, WYATT.com. And you can find some of my own journalism on church affairs and other things on my website, tswyatt.com. And I'd also encourage you, if you're interested in that kind of thing, to sign up to my weekly Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend, which is for free. All details on my website, tswyatt.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Mercy Ships is transforming lives across Africa through medical training and free surgery. Joining me is Dr. Manjeet Dhillon, a volunteer surgeon. Dr. Manjeet, for anyone who doesn't know, what does Mercy Ships actually do?
Mercy Ships is a faith-based charity who deploy hospital ships to some of the poorest parts of the world. And our hospital ship will dock for several months in places where people simply can't access safe surgery. On board, we have everything you would find in a modern hospital. Patients are offered world-class surgery completely free of charge, and at the same time, we train local doctors and nurses so they can keep providing care after we're gone.
You must have met so many people whose lives have been changed. Are there any that stayed with you?
On a recent visit to Madagascar, I met 2-year-old Armella. She was born with a grapefruit-sized tumour behind her ear. Her mum prayed every day that someone would help her. And when our ship arrived, myself and other medical and nursing volunteers from around the world removed the tumour free of charge. Now Armella is healthy, happy and full of life.
And how can listeners help more people like Armella?
Right now, every gift is being matched pound for pound up to $400,000. Your generosity could help a child get the surgery they've been waiting for or help train a nurse or doctor to change lives for years to come.
Thank you, Dr. Manjeet. If you'd like to help transform more lives like Armella's, visit mercyships.org.uk.